Welcome, everyone, to Banfield. I'm going to begin right off the top with some breaking news, and I want you to listen and listen real careful, because for about 50 years or so, a lot of people figured they didn't have to listen to this issue. It was settled law. Right across the country, the Supreme Court said so. Abortion rights. Yeah, abortion rights. You probably haven't thought much about it unless you live in a couple of states that recently have restricted women's access to abortion. But there's always that pesky challenge that goes all the way to, you know, that place, the Supreme Court. And we've been waiting on some decisions. But we always have to wait till June because it takes a while to get these things done. Those nine justices are busy all year long when you don't see them and when you don't hear about their opinions and their decisions until tonight. Because tonight something weird happened, something that I've never seen happen, and I will lay it on you that you have never seen it happen either. A leak. A leak of a decision. And by the way, when they make a decision, one of those justices writes the opinion of the majority, the person that wins that case, right? And tonight the leak is of the opinion about an abortion case. And no matter where you fall on the abortion rights issue, this is monumental because those nine justices are likely, if this leaked opinion is what's going to be actually officially released in June, well, they just overturned Roe versus Wade effectively. So that's a big deal. And when I say they've overturned Roe versus Wade, they've actually, it looks like, made a decision on the Mississippi law that restricts abortion to before 15 weeks. And that went to the Supreme Court because those challenging it said, wait a second, Roe versus Wade says you can't do that. It's the law of the land. And the Supreme Court, that is now majority conservative, apparently has made its decision quietly. We're not supposed to know about it yet. We're not supposed to know until that opinion gets released in June. But tonight, the thing that's never supposed to happen, a leak of what those justices write behind closed doors in their chambers, a leak has happened. And that leak suggests they took a vote. And of the nine, I don't know how many said no and how many said yes, but the majority agreed with Mississippi. And that means that right across the land, abortion rights are no longer the way they were before. Now, right now, as we stand, it is May the 2nd, 2022, and the law of the land is still Roe v. Wade. This hasn't dropped. This hasn't been made official. It's something called a draft. And the draft is what's likely to be released officially. So, breaking news tonight. A draft says Roe v. Wade will no longer hold as the law of the land, as your constitutional right to an abortion. So conservatives are understandably thrilled with this because this has been a conservative push for a long time. That is why the conservatives have pushed hard for Donald Trump to get conservative justices on the Supreme Court. And this was what they wanted it for. So if you're conservative and this was your issue, tonight it looks like you have won. If you are Democrat and this was your issue, but you didn't think it was at risk, tonight you have lost. Again, it's a draft. Anything can change. But at this point, this looks to be the law of the land, which is about to change. We're going to continue to follow this on News Nation. It is big news, obviously. And we'll continue to watch this in the hours as well. In the meantime, we've got one of those things called the BOLO right across the country tonight. It's a be on the lookout. And this BOLO is for Casey White, 6'9", wanted for alleged murder. A manhunt for an accused murderer. It's a big headline on its own, but it is the reason that Casey White's on the loose that's really getting all the attention. Because he didn't just break out of jail Shawshank style. He got a ride out of jail. And the corrections officer who drove him is a wanted woman as well tonight. On Friday morning, Officer Vicky White, the assistant director of corrections, told her colleagues at the jail that she was taking Casey White, no relation, to the county courthouse for a mental evaluation. And out they went right through the Sally Port together. However, there was no such appointment on anyone's books. And according to law enforcement, there's timestamp video that shows Vicky White and Casey White abandoned her cruiser just 8 minutes after it left that Sally Port. no stop at the county courthouse. So that is probably why we got this announcement today from the sheriff of Lauderdale County in Alabama.
The other thing that I want to make you aware of today is that we have had a warrant issued for Director Vicki White. The charges are permitting or facilitating escape in the first degree. That's Alabama Code 13A-20-34. So there is an active warrant out for Ms. White, obviously for Casey White. So we're in hopes that we'll get some much-needed breaks here in the next few days that will help us locate them and get them back here to Lauderdale County and get Casey White, especially behind bars.
You know, at first it was thought that Vicki may have been kidnapped because she was, quote, an exemplary employee with an unblemished record. But the sheriff now says it looks like Vicki White was instead an accomplice. So the manhunt has now turned into a woman hunt, too. The United States Marshals Service is offering a $10,000 reward for information leading to the capture of Casey White and the location of Vicki White as well. And make no mistake, Casey White is a very dangerous guy. He was serving 75 years after being convicted of attempted murder, kidnapping, robbery, and burglary. And he was in the Lauderdale County Detention Center awaiting trial for capital murder. Here's the good news, though. At 6'9" and 260, he's going to be easy to spot. He has tattoos on his back and on his left shoulder and all the way down his right arm, as you can see in these pictures that were taken actually not that long ago inside that correction center. For more now, I want to turn to News Nation correspondent Kelly Beeson. Kelly, 4 days now that the two have been on the run. I dare say that seems like a trail growing cold, but what do the authorities think?
Well, it's certainly more of a challenge now, Ashley, to locate these two. And the big question is, did Vicki White do this willingly or was she coerced? The possibility of a romantic relationship between the two is also now being investigated.
This is not the Vicki White we know.
Vicki White is the Assistant Director of Corrections for the Lauderdale County Detention Center in Florence, Alabama. According to the sheriff, she worked for the department for close to 16 years and was highly respected among her colleagues.
She has been an exemplary employee. You know, we just hope that this has a good ending.
On Friday morning, she informed the staff she was transporting a nearly 7-foot-tall inmate, 38-year-old Casey White, to a courthouse for a mental health evaluation, though none was scheduled. The sheriff's office says Vicki White violated a policy that required more than one officer to be involved in transporting Casey White. Rules put in place when he was jailed 2 years ago, and authorities believed he was planning to escape.
This is a serious inmate. So shame on the person that opened that door to let them out.
Just put the gun down.
Casey White had a history of run-ins with the law, already serving a prison sentence for attempted murder and burglary when he disappeared, and was scheduled for a trial next month on a capital murder charge. In 2020, he confessed to killing 58-year-old Connie Ridgway, and if convicted, could face the death penalty.
Totally shocked. I mean, just completely shocked. Like, how is it even possible?
Austin Williams is the son of Ridgway, who says he wants to see Casey White go to trial and voiced his frustration about the escape.
Somebody really needs to find out how this happened.
Federal prison correction consultant Maureen Baird telling News Nation the danger to the area now is significant.
She's armed, which means he's armed. So if he overpowered her or if she's facilitating an escape, he's armed either way. And putting a firearm in this guy's hands, I would be very concerned if I was living in that community.
And as you mentioned, Ashley, the U.S. Marshal Service is now offering up to a $10,000 reward for information in this case.
Oh, Kelly, thank you for that. What a bizarre story. Just the fact that it was so easy and no one noticed, despite the fact they had a policy, you know, two people need to drive an inmate out, not one. Thank you for that, Kelly Beeson, reporting for us. You know, 2 years ago, while Casey was behind bars, he actually made a confession. This is a bit weird. He confessed to a despicable crime that happened back in 2015. It was the home invasion and stabbing death of a 58-year-old woman named Connie Ridgway. Connie's murder had gone unsolved until, for whatever reason, Casey decided to just blab about it, taking credit for it in prison. He, however, pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, and he was awaiting trial for this when suddenly he vanished along with Officer Vicky White on Friday. Connie had two sons, Austin and Cameron. We've got a picture of them with their mom, obviously in better days. And so you can imagine what it would be like to hear about your mom's alleged killer, these two boys, getting a call to say he's escaped. Joining us now is one of those sons, Austin Williams. Austin, thank you for being with me, and I'm so sorry it's under these circumstances. How was it that you became aware that that this inmate had left the facility and had left with a corrections officer?
Well, the district attorney called me Friday at 5:30 before the news broke to let me know that he had escaped, and I didn't have any details then, but I was just I was completely shocked.
Shock, I would say, would be one thing, but I would imagine anger would set in thereafter. Is that what happened?
Yeah, I mean, quite angry. Like, how in the world is this possible? We waited and waited for 5 years and struggled to get during a cold case, and he had confessed, and we had him. And then all of a sudden, he's gone. He's not just gone by his own power. Someone actually helped him escape. That's just even more shocking. It's just unbelievable.
So early in this, and it's only 4 days old since the two, you know, left that Sally Port on Friday morning. But early in this, most people thought that maybe Vicky White was doing this against her will and was instead a hostage as opposed to an accomplice. Did you feel one way or the other? Are you as surprised as I am tonight when all of a sudden the announcement's made that she's now been charged?
Yeah, I'm pretty surprised. I mean, it sounded really bad. They had such a head start, and it just seemed like it was a little bit too easy for him. But I was surprised based on what everyone had said about her track record, that she's a very good employee, exemplary employee of the year. It's what would anybody be doing with this guy who's like a level 10 threat?
Has anybody reached out to you to apologize or to at least keep you apprised in a different way than say, you know, the rest of us, how we find out? Are you finding out like the rest of us about the details in this escape?
I do have contact information for the sheriff and district attorney, and I haven't reached them because I want them focused on catching this guy. It's unfortunate, very unfortunate what happened, but I haven't reached them yet. I've been kind of finding out, kind of like you guys.
Do you have a message for Casey White if he's out there somewhere watching tonight?
Yeah, I would say give yourself up, because we're going to find you. Everybody knows who you are and what you've done. So you need to give yourself up as soon as possible while there's still time, there's still hope.
Well, listen, Austin, I'm so sorry for, you know, A, what you went through with the loss of your mother, and then B, this just added trauma and stress with the hunt for this, you know, alleged killer. So I wish you the best, and let's try and keep in touch as they continue this manhunt.
Sure. Thank you. It means a lot. I mean, I used to think I was kind of living in a nightmare. Now I'm starting to wonder if I might wake up tomorrow, but I really do appreciate it. It means a lot.
Well, we'll keep that word out. Austin Williams, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
All right, I want to return to our top story, and that is that a leaked memo that was never supposed to be leaked essentially appears to show that Roe v. Wade is done in this country. 49 years since a decision that legalized abortion across the country, made abortion the law of the land for women. That may not be the case anymore if this draft opinion that was leaked by Justice Samuel Alito, a conservative justice on the Supreme Court, if it's in effect going to be the decision and the majority opinion that is released in June, which is typically when opinions should be released. I want to go right now to Katie Cherkaski, who is a former federal prosecutor. Katie, I'm assuming, look, there are legal minds, and then there are people like you who worked, you know, as a former federal prosecutor. This is like, there's so many things that I could say. It's shocking, the decision, but it's also shocking, the leak. So take me from there.
Absolutely. This is completely unprecedented to have a Supreme Court decision, especially something of this magnitude, leaked early. And it is cause for some suspicion on that end. Of course, this is not a final decision, even if it is in fact legitimate, as Politico has maintained. But essentially, we've been hearing a lot about abortion over the past couple of years now, and there has been a chipping away, if you will, of the federal protection to abortion through a lot of other state laws. So it may not be surprising, if not very unwelcome to many people, that this could be the majority's position to overturn Roe versus Wade, which should be pointed out that that does not mean abortion is illegal. It just returns the issue to the states to regulate. It does not supply any federal protection. And that's kind of the key difference.
So, I think if people are watching, they'll fall in two baskets. Usually people aren't on defense about abortion. They're either for it or against it. And the folks who are for it, who may have been, sitting back on their laurels for the last 49 years, figuring, the Supreme Court has spoken, so done with that issue. They might be shaking in their boots, fearing, or be very angry tonight. And many will be thinking, well, it's just a draft opinion. It can't, maybe there's a chance. So, Katie, when we say draft opinion, right, it's not the final opinion. It's not the law of the land right now. But is there any chance that that won't be the final law of the land, that final opinion?
Well, absolutely. The justices, even if this is a legitimate opinion, because again, it's coming from a very suspicious sort of source at this point. We don't really know. It's kind of been an unprecedented thing to have happen in the first place. So it's not final, even if it is legitimate. And to the extent that this does become the law of the land, I don't know that that would be particularly surprising. We've seen what's happened with Texas and some of these other states creating these workaround laws over the past several years that have been upheld by the Supreme Court. So I think a lot of people have been reading the tea leaves, and with the conservative majority on the court, this has been something that has been a concern for many people. But again, it is not a permanent decision. It's not final by any means, and the justices can change their opinions and their alliances long before the opinion is issued, if in fact this is going to be the majority's opinion from the court.
Let me ask you this. Julia Manchester tweeting out tonight that Democratic Senate candidates across the country are calling on the filibuster to be eliminated in response to Politico obtaining this draft of a SCOTUS decision striking down Roe v. Wade. So make that make sense for people when, the frustration is that, oh, dear, if the Supreme Court has spoken, and let's just assume that that draft opinion saying Roe v. Wade is done becomes law of the land, becomes the decision, and becomes the majority opinion that's on record in June. What does it mean in terms of the filibuster to change that, just in layman's terms?
Well, if this becomes the majority opinion, then essentially what that means is that there is no federal protection for abortion, and that states are free to regulate that as they wish. So states can lawfully allow abortion, and states can decide to not allow that. As of right now, the Supreme Court prohibits any sort of undue burden on obtaining abortion by a state. So that's kind of open to interpretation in and of itself. So in terms of what may happen, it's going to just be a state-based issue moving ahead. That will be the law. There will not be federal protection that prohibits states from limiting or really eliminating the right to abortion altogether, if that's what they so choose. But on the flip side, they can completely and fully allow abortion without interference as well from the federal government.
So what you're saying is that the filibuster would allow at least a Democratic majority to pass a law that would override those state laws. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And so essentially every state would have the right to regulate the issue without any interference from the federal government, because it wouldn't be a matter of constitutional concern, because according to this draft opinion, there has never been a direct link to abortion rights in the Constitution. It's something that's been interpreted under the broad right to privacy. And many conservatives and justices on the court have long believed that that does not entail a right to abortion. That's just been kind of created. So they're just taking that away, and any further litigation or legislation on the issue would be left up to individual state legislatures.
Yeah, you and I would be having a way different conversation if this weren't an abortion opinion, right? Like, we'd be finding out who the heck got their hands on this thing and who the heck you know, release this thing. It's never happened, at least in the recent history of the Supreme Court, maybe ever. I haven't had time to go through the records, but that's a big shock in itself, and that'll be a story in its own right. But right now, clearly the story that's sort of walloping everybody across the head tonight is the fact that Roe v. Wade, no more, if what this leaked memo, this leaked draft opinion says is going to be the official opinion from Justice Samuel Alito. But wow, what a big story. And I thank you for scrambling for us so last minute, because this just happened within the last hour and a half. Thank you so much, Katie Tracaski. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Okay, and straight ahead, a cold case whose time may finally have come. It's the 1996 murder of six-year-old JonBenet Ramsey. JonBenet's father, John, is calling on the governor of Colorado to take DNA evidence out of the hands of the Boulder police and let independent experts try to do the same thing in their case that the police did in the Golden State Killer's case: identify a suspect using genealogy. And you know what? The governor has responded. JonBenet's father, John Ramsey, joins me live next with his first public comments since the governor said he would indeed look at this petition. That's next. When it comes to catching killers, there are those who are physically on the run, like that guy, Casey White, who's out there tonight searching for him with the corrections officer who allegedly helped him, you know, spring from prison. And then there are those who are always going to be looking over their shoulder, like the killers that we haven't found yet. And time is rarely on the side of the good guys here. Evidence and memories, they don't get better with age, but there is one thing that does: technology. That gets better with age. You can just ask Joseph DeAngelo, whose Golden State murders were kept secret for decades until the advent of a whole new sphere of police work called forensic genealogy, crime scene DNA matched against online genetic databases. That was what led police to one of DeAngelo's relatives, and other clues zeroed in on that predator himself. We know him as the Golden State Killer, and he was locked away because of it. That was in 2018, and there has been 4 years of advances in forensic genealogy since then. So maybe now, right now, in the hands of the right people, forensic genealogy might find the killer of JonBenet Ramsey, who was found bludgeoned and strangled in the basement of her own home in Boulder, Colorado, the day after Christmas in 1996. She was 6 years old, and if you were around at that time, I hardly need to remind you of this. Her case was a global sensation, first because of the crime itself, and later, as time dragged on with no arrests, because of the investigation, which was sloppy at best and incompetent at worst. There were, and I quote, false investigative starts, wild conspiracy theories, and a seemingly infinite number of accusations against nearly everyone involved in this case. And I'm quoting an online petition that was just launched by JonBenet's dad, John Ramsey. He, his late wife Patsy, and their son Burke have been the subjects of accusations and innuendo, but they were publicly cleared back in 2008 by DNA. Let me repeat that: publicly cleared by DNA 14 years ago. Now John wants the governor of Colorado to let a third party try to match genetic evidence from the JonBenet crime scene with a plausible suspect, just like the police matched a suspect with familial DNA in that Golden State Killer case. And I've got breaking news for you on this tonight. The governor has agreed to review John's petition. The Boulder police say they have almost 1,000 DNA samples to work with, among more than 1,500 pieces of evidence. They say they've checked out more than 20,000 tips and traveled to 19 states to question more than 1,000 people. But still, after 25 years and 4 months, no one has been charged. Now John Ramsey wants action, and he joins me live tonight. John, thank you so much for you know, joining me on such short notice. I mean, this is really quite miraculous news. The governor has responded tonight. He says he will consider your petition. I'd love to hear your reaction.
Well, yes, his response certainly was encouraging. We hope that that'll be followed by action and not just words. You said exactly what we're looking for, Ashley. DNA technology has advanced so far and so fast that it needs to be applied to this case. And the problem is, there's two problems. One, there's crime scene evidence that's never been tested, that should be tested. It most likely was handled by the killer. That needs to be sampled for DNA. Secondly, we had a meeting with the FBI a couple of months ago, and they said, you know, look, we don't even have the latest technology in government. You know, we have to get a budget, we have to put out a requisition, and then we eventually get the technology to use. It takes time, and this technology is moving so fast. They said there's only the best way to do it, the only way to do it, is to go to one of the few independent labs that are out there that really have the latest technology. And that's what we're asking the governor to do. You know, the police said, well, we have DNA people. They don't have the latest technology. They really do not. And it's just time to admit that and get on with it. This familial DNA database tracking, which found the Golden State Killer and many others since then, is a remarkable type of police work. I know it's a lot of work, but it's yielded some amazing results in terms of old cold cases that have never been solved up until the use of that technology to kind of go backwards. Yeah. And use the vast database of DNA that's out there now. When I first got involved in this case, obviously, I thought, you know, there's no DNA databases back in the 90s. And it turns out there was a database the FBI set up, but there was no data in it to speak of. And some states were behind, some states didn't submit samples. It's a whole mix of things. But with this public database now that's out there, I volunteered, put my DNA in. I wanted to see what my ancestry was. And it's massive. And to not use that today is... It's sad.
It seems criminal. It really does. It seems criminal. I understand some of the reasons, the privacy issues that came around in the last 5 to 10 years. But for anybody who's not following right now, John, I mean, you and I kind of live this stuff regularly. But, you know, back in the day, like 1996, when John Binney died, the DNA databases really only consisted of criminals. You know, you collected the DNA of criminals and you put them into the database. And then along came, you know, 23andMe and all these genealogy gifts that you can send around to your family, and suddenly we had DNA information on hundreds of millions of people all around the world, and those people could lead you to a family member who maybe had not submitted their DNA. So that's the essence of why this is so much more of a robust tool now. But my question for you, John, is this. First, I can't understand why the Boulder police wouldn't be desperate to solve this and do anything and everything they could to access familial DNA and genetics DNA databases like 23andMe, et cetera. But secondly, and it's a two-parter, do you have confidence that the governor is really going to put his shoulder behind this and help you?
Well, the answer to the first question is I don't really know. It's hard to understand their mentality. You know, they decided, first of all, they had no experience in homicide investigation. Small town, fairly peaceful. They didn't have a homicide detective when this happened. So they had no experience, and I don't fault them for that. What I do fault them for is they turned down help from people that knew what they were doing, and they continue to do so today. That type of arrogance and ego and this is my case, nobody can take it away, is a real problem. And that's what we were fighting against. And they decided, I think, frankly, the first day that the family did it. They were in the house, had to be one of the family members. Burke, my 9-year-old child, me, or Patsy. Just didn't know which one. And that was the conclusion. And then they went about, okay, now let's put together some evidence to prove it. This all happened in the first week, probably. And they started coming up with evidence that conflicted with that conclusion, and which was a problem for them. But they've never, I don't think, gotten off that conclusion that it was one of the parents. The same people are there today that managed this case 25 years ago. They were young novices then, and I don't know if they've learned a whole lot more since. But this reluctance to pursue the killer is just, I do not understand it, and it's not acceptable.
Do you think the governor is going to really forcefully work on your case, help you to finally get justice?
Well, we hope so. I mean, we basically have put out this petition, which is on change.org/justiceforJBR, and asked people to sign it. We've got, I think, over 2,500 signatures now on it. People care about it and want it solved. And we're not asking the government to do anything that they shouldn't be doing. We're just asking them to do what they should be doing. We're not asking for an apology. We're not asking for exoneration. Just do your job and do it as best it can be done with today's modern technology. Now, the police will say, oh, we use the latest technology. We have our own DNA experts. They don't. The FBI admitted they don't have it. They don't have the latest stuff. They said you have to go to an outside lab, of which there's probably less than three or four in the country that are very capable of doing this very sophisticated DNA analysis. So that's what we're asking for.
Well, I'm pulling for you, and I've said this to you on air before. I've given you a national apology for the way that you were treated in the last 26 years by the press, by the police. Patsy died before she could know that there was an exoneration of you and your son and Patsy. And I can't believe you even agree to these interviews, given what you've been through. So I'm very thankful that you're with us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me on the program, Ashley. And you know, you folks can help push this along, too, by publicizing it. You know, there's a bigger issue here, which I'm really going to get focused on. This happened because we have 18,000 police jurisdictions in this country. Each one's a little island of authority, and they have full control over and responsibility for crimes that happen in their territory. And a small community like Boulder doesn't have the expertise to be expert at everything, and certainly not this type of homicide. They can ask for help from people like the FBI, the Denver police, people that have lots of experience. But if they don't ask for it and invite them in, it can't be given. And that was the tragedy here. If you remember the old Andy Griffith, Barney Fife program, you know, Andy was the wise old sheriff and Barney was the deputy in Mayberry, and Barney wouldn't give him bullets for his gun because he's afraid to shoot somebody. If that murder had happened in Mayberry, it'd be up to Barney Fife to solve it, unless he asked for help. What I'd like to see is a federal crime statute be created that made the murder of a child be a federal offense, so that help would come in. You know, we care about our money. If a bank's robbed, the FBI comes in immediately. If a child is murdered, nothing happens unless the local people ask for help. And that's wrong. We don't care about it.
I think that's a whole other area once the governor handles this case, that maybe that can be our next conversation. In the meantime, I'd love to stay in touch with you to see what happens next. If you meet with the governor, what he decides in terms of the review. And I can't thank you again enough for you know, being on the program tonight. And good luck to you.
Thank you, Ashley. Thank you very much.
John Ramsey joining us live tonight from Moab in Utah. Still to come, a cult leader on the run. Warren Jeff's story make headlines across the country. He had dozens of wives and dozens of children when the feds finally caught up with him. Some of those wives were just 12 years old. But there is so much of the story that we've never heard until tonight. And one of his children joins me live next. Welcome back to Banfield. Very few people know what it's like to grow up in a family where their father is considered a prophet, God's man on the ground. But one person who knows exactly what that's like is my next guest. He's the son of Warren Jeffs, controversial former leader of the Fundamentalist Church of Latter-day Saints, or FLDS. As leader, Warren Jeffs had dozens and dozens of wives, some of them as young as 12. His story is laid out in a new docuseries called Preaching Evil, A Wife on the Run with Warren Jeffs, and it's streaming now on Peacock. It includes interviews with my next guest, Warren's son, Wendell Jessen. Wendell, thank you so much for being on tonight. Boy, have I ever wanted to talk to you for a long time, because I have covered your father's case, his conviction, his sentencing, and everything that led up to it. But I've rarely been able to find out anything from the other side. What can you tell me tonight about life on the inside in Warren Jeff's family?
Well, thank you for having me. First, I would just say, you know, you can't really see the other side with your blindfold on. We didn't know we were blindfolded, I guess. We grew up so secluded from the outside world that we didn't know any different. I can't say I lived a miserable life because I didn't know what the outside world was like. I grew up on a compound in Texas where there was nothing but the wildlife around us. We had no internet, no movies, music. We literally worked in the garden. Our whole focus was around Warren Jeffs and the religion that he was trying to build and the cult that he was creating.
But it seemed so weird to all of us to hear, and I'm only assuming that it didn't seem weird at all to you, because how would you know that there he was with dozens of wives, and some of them were just children, which would mean that, you know, your stepmoms were 12 years old. I mean, did you ever functionally process that? Did it ever come up in your mind that something's weird here, something doesn't seem right?
Absolutely. And I remember I was 4 years old. Well, I was actually 5 years old when he was arrested and when Warren Jeffs went to jail. So he didn't marry any more young wives when I was really old enough to comprehend how young they actually were coming into the family. And so I saw them at a very young age, and I saw his age difference, and I had questions about that. But whether it was right or wrong, at that age of 4 or 5 years old, I didn't really know any better. Now it's another story once I got older and I like understood how young these girls were, then I really began to question what his intentions were and if everything that he had taught us was as right as he had said it was.
And what about your mom? Did she ever seem out of sorts, or how does she feel now about knowing that he was a pedophile, a rapist, a child rapist?
Yeah, so I have to give it to my mom. She's one of the strongest people that I know. She was obviously assigned into an arranged marriage, as all marriages in the FLDS were. They're all arranged marriages. She didn't really have a choice in where she went or who she was assigned to. And so going into that family, she saw that there was a lot of wrong going on inside the family. And I think from a very early stage, she was trying to strategically leave without losing her children. And I think us as her kids, we were the main thing keeping her there without her just saying, I'm out, I'm leaving, because she wanted to take us with her. But she didn't agree with it at all.
So I remember covering the day that you, and now you tell me, I think you were probably 7 years old. I remember covering the story when the Texas ranch was raided by the feds, and I think 500 children were led out and put onto buses. And we were never able to talk to anybody about it, certainly not the children. And here you are. Do you remember that day? Do you remember what it was like?
Absolutely. It's something that I definitely can never forget. And I do want to preface that with saying that we were brainwashed in the FLDS. As an entire family, as an entire religion or cult, we were brainwashed. And we believed that everybody outside of our community was there to kill us. They wanted to hurt us, and they had only bad intentions. So when we had these Texas Rangers come in, obviously responding to the calls that they had been receiving of sexual abuse, but we didn't know that. They come in as a seven-year-old kid. I see people with guns, and it just kind of confirmed everything that we had been taught growing up, that they were there to hurt us or to kill us.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, how terrifying it would be, and it wouldn't have helped that the women were still so complicit, you know, for so long, even through the trial. I'm just going to reiterate that the special, the new docuseries, is called Preaching Evil, A Wife on the Run with Warren Jeffs. It sounds incredible. I can't wait to watch it. And I'm really thankful that you're able to sort of tell everybody what it was like, even at such a young age. And I'm happy that you're, you know, on the road to a great recovery as well. Wendell, thanks so much for being on tonight. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
This is fascinating. Coming up after the break, our top story. Wow, oh wow, a leaked majority opinion from the Supreme Court. That in itself would be a story, but for the fact that the story itself is what that memo was about. Roe v. Wade effectively will be gone as law of the land if that majority opinion does not change before it's officially released in June. That's next.